Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Radio Tony and Tony TV. This is a wonderful series with Dr. Olivia Ong. But before we get on and I introduce you, let me remind you, if you're watching this live on YouTube, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitch, and Twitter, we will have Payo ready and waiting to take your comments, questions, and forward you links and information about our wonderful guest today. If you're missing the live show, don't forget you can catch up on Tony TV on all Roku, LG, and Samsung apps across the world, and Binge TV Networks USA, HeroGo TV Networks USA. And don't forget, you can also watch us and catch up with shows on YouTube. Don't forget to subscribe. Now, our beautiful guest, Dr. Olivia Ong, is the founder and CEO of Dr. Olivia Ong, the Heart-Centered Doctor. And before I introduce you to our amazing guest today, I want to let you know a little bit about Olivia. As a compassionate leadership and resilient speaker, Dr. Olivia's story tells a story of how she overcame a devastating spinal cord injury when she was a resident in 2008. She learned to walk again functionally with two sticks and a limp after four agonizing years. Dr. Olivia's spinal cord injury taught her a very important lesson, and that is self-compassion. This is the premise behind her creative business, Dr. Olivia Ong, the Heart-Centered Doctor. As an author, Olivia has just finished writing her first book, The Heart-Centeredness of Medicine. And she wrote the book after seeing so many of her colleagues firsthand and secondhand burnout due to overwork and stress. She writes in a way that helps doctors find their way back home to their heart. Olivia wants them to be able to lead heart-centered lives that they truly deserve. As a medical leadership coach and mentor, Dr. Olivia helps busy, high-achieving, heart-centered doctors avoid burnout and exhaustion to achieve balanced energy and time flexibility through her life transformation, the Doctors Program. She offers one-on-one coaching, workshops, and speaking engagements on burnout, compassion, fatigue, and vicarious trauma in doctors so that they can stay in the game longer and as a compassionate leader and lead a positive legacy for upcoming generations of young doctors. Welcome to the show, Dr. Olivia.
Thanks, Tony, for having me.
Now, I wanted to start the show today with one of your favorite quotes, and it's one of mine too, but it's a beautiful quote. And it's from Maya Angelou. And she says, "I've learned that people will forget what you said. People will forget what you did, but people will never forget the way you made them feel." Olivia, that's so important when we're talking about medicine and doctors, isn't it?
Exactly.
For doctors, they're in the caring position. However, they've had to do so much learning, education to get to that point where they're caring for other human beings. What does that quote specifically mean to you?
I guess why this quote is so meaningful to me, because I remember what it was like not to have any emotions or feelings at all. Especially when I was I'm still working as a doctor, but back in the days when I was quite burnt out, I literally had no emotions in me. So I forgot how to feel. And once I managed to learn to feel again. And that's when I truly felt that I was healing from the inside out. And I've been so inspired by many people along the way. Tony, I had a spinal cord injury years ago, and I've met a lot of very interesting people along the way, fellow spinal cord injury survivors.
Yes.
And I've met inspirational people along the way as well. And since I started my business this year, I've met a lot of inspirational entrepreneurs, including yourself. So I think this quote is so much more meaningful because, you know,
what you've been through.
Such a big thing.
Yes.
Exactly. It just emotions is what makes us human. So that's why I think Maya Angelou's quote just means a lot to me.
Yeah. Now, Dr. Olivia, this is the first of three shows that we're going to do together. And I thought that I'd like to begin telling the audience about you, your childhood, growing up, and what led you into medicine in the first place.
Yeah, so when I was seven, for the 7 years before that, I stayed in Jakarta, Indonesia. That's where my
Yes.
parents are from. They're Indonesian Chinese. So we stayed in Jakarta and then we moved or migrated to Singapore when I was seven. So basically, I had to not only transition in an environment where I had to learn English because I couldn't speak English at all. It was a new culture for me. And that's
Definitely.
basically my childhood. I started at seven being quite awkward, not being able to speak English. But then I made friends, and I think as when I was growing up, my parents made sure that I had a normal or great childhood. They made sure that they taught us a lot of. I have two younger brothers, so they taught all of us, three of us, life lessons, and they made sure that we had the best education we could have, and also that we had a normal childhood. Like I remember my brothers playing video games. I think at that time it was Nintendo and Sega. I mean, they probably don't have that now, but that was in our time. And I remember my parents taking me out to watch movies quite frequently.
Oh, good.
And that led to my current, I guess, same practice as I take my kids out to watch movies as well, because there's
They're
such beautiful
great.
thing watching a movie together as a
Yes.
family.
I have to agree with
And
you that
exactly.
cinema experience with the big screen, it actually you can immerse yourself in the story and it takes you out of your everyday life and same. I did the same thing with my kids going to movies as well. So life in Singapore, at what stage did you end up in Australia?
Well, I completed the A levels examination, which is like equivalent year 12 here in
12.
Australia. I did that in Singapore. So I got the grades enough to get, I guess, get me into medicine.
Yes,
But I've
which
always
is
wanted to do
tough.
medicine. Yeah, it is tough, but it's always been my ambition since I was 15. So I when I was 15, I when since I was 15 rather, I started volunteering in nursing homes and homes for the intellectually disabled, just helping people out, just like telling them stories. And I think I've just been a storyteller since I was a kid because I guess my parents have brought me and my
Brought
brothers to
that.
watch movies. I mean, my first movie was Honey, I Shrunk the Kids in
Oh, yeah,
1989. Yeah,
that was
that was a fantastic movie. And I fell in love with storytelling since then. And
great.
I've loved reading books as well. And in high school, not only was I the school librarian, I was in drama class. And I also helped out in volunteer work in nursing homes and homes for intellectually disabled. And
Yeah,
that's probably how I
where it
got
started.
into, yeah, where my heart for medicine started, because I just wanted to help people.
Yes.
And then, yeah, I guess that
Led
drive
to
was
that
enough, I guess.
drive. Yeah.
Exactly,
Because
exactly.
it's for people to the audience to understand, getting into medicine is no mean feat. So not only do you have to do incredibly well at school, then you have to be in the top of the top to get into the various universities across the world, anywhere. It's pretty much the same, isn't it? So
Yeah,
you got
exactly.
into university, so grade 12, got good grades, achieved that ideal of, okay, now I can pursue medicine. Did that dream start in Singapore and or did it start in Australia?
I think when I was in year 12 in Singapore, I kind of visualized a life in medicine, but I think it only became a reality when I started medicine in 1999. And I had a really beautiful a really great experience doing my medical degree here in Australia, because Singapore is a very regimented, strict culture where our educational curriculum was pretty tight and we had to fulfill the grades. But I think in Australia it allowed me to be free, not only to socialize with many like-minded friends, but also free to be me, which is something that I kind of never really found me
Yes.
in Singapore because of
Yes.
so much academic
Yes.
expectations to fulfill. Like to enter medicine, I had to study
Yes.
really hard
Yes.
in high school. I had to not hang out with my friends as much. So I think university was just that
Yes.
freedom of experience to, yeah, just to pursue my own ideas and not have any objections to it. So it was just great. So 6 years, I enjoyed, medicine has its tough times where we obviously
Yes.
had exams and things, but I had great friends and they made me feel like, I belong in a community. So I felt like I belong
Yeah.
to, I guess, a tribe, say.
Yes. The whole so it's 6 years university, and those 6 years are lots of exams, lots of learning, lots of studying. It's a big deal. And then once you get to that point, then you start like full time in hospital and healthcare settings, which is a whole nother story in itself, isn't it? I, as you know, I'm a nurse, and my training began as hospital-based training, and it wasn't until we were almost towards the end of our training that it started to transition into the university level training. So we had a lot of affinity with the resident doctors, and it was a very good learning environment where we learnt together how to do things, how not to do things, and it was very collaborative. And so that's changed a little, I think, in healthcare over that intervening time. I'm talking 35 years ago. So residency, tell me about being a resident doctor.
So when I started my internship in 2005, there was a steep learning curve for me.
Yes.
So, in medical school, it's all well and good exams, but that doesn't prepare all of us. I speak for all of us. When we start our first day as an intern, we actually are in charge and we have to make life and death decisions. That's a big change.
It
And in terms of, in terms of interventional skills or like
is.
putting in intravenous drips, like we have to
Yes.
get quite proficient at it very quickly because our
Correct.
task list just keeps growing otherwise.
That's right.
And yeah, so the first year as an intern, I spent, just, up leveling myself, making
Yeah.
sure that I'm proficient with my intervention skills. And as a re and then the following year are the resident years, which is kind of in between
It is.
intern and registrar, but
Yes.
it's kind of that. Those couple of years is where we try to figure out which career path we end up doing, whether we end up going to be subspecializing as a surgeon or a physician or GP or anesthetist and
And
things like
they're
that.
all very different parts of medicine. And I often wondered how doctors decide, because, being a nurse, I saw how junior registrars rather, and junior doctors were treated. And I'm like, how do they survive? It's particularly those that were interested in surgery, because being a perioperative nurse, that's where I had most of my experience. And the way that they were treated was just appalling in most instances. And I always remember thinking, how do these doctors eventually fly out and do their own specialty? Because they were overworked, they were stressed, there was a lot of study, there was a lot of bullying, and just that horrible behavior, Olivia. What made you choose your specialties in the first instance?
Yeah, interestingly, I chose rehabilitation medicine,
Yeah.
which turned out to be irony later on, as I will probably
Absolutely.
talk about in the
Yes.
interview. But I chose this particular specialty because I saw what doctors can do when they work with a team. So, as a rehab
Absolutely.
physician, we work with physios, psychologists, occupational therapists, and our main goal is to put our patient, obviously, as the center of our focus, getting them, I guess, rehabilitating them in a way that they can
Yes.
lead the life that they had initially, a new normal perhaps, but achieving the goals that they want. It's about goal setting, it's about achieving goals. And the patients do report quite great satisfaction in the rehabilitation ward when they relearn, have to relearn the skills. But
Yeah.
it's just a joy to watch patients, transition from not being able to walk to walking out of the ward a couple of weeks later. And just and it's not just journey with the patient, it's a journey with the family as well. It's very
Definitely.
Collaborative.
Mm.
Yeah, that's why I enjoy the specialty so much.
The human
and I still
body,
practice as a referee.
Yes, of course, you still practice. The human body is an amazing vehicle for healing. Mm. And if you, as you said, have a wonderful team around you that helps you do that rehabilitation, the body can achieve amazing things, can't it?
Exactly, exactly.
So let's talk about your own injury and rehab. I think it's important for the audience to understand that you, not only are you a rehab specialist, you are also a pain specialist, which is a wonderful combination of skills to have, but they would have helped in your journey. So let's talk about that injury.
Yeah, so my injury happened in 2008, September.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in 2008 was a pretty significant year. It was the first year, Tony, where I started working as a rehabilitation registrar. So I was really excited. I was pumped.
Yes.
I was like, yeah, I was.
This is good.
You know, I was actually enjoying my work. Previously, obviously, when I was a resident, I wasn't really enjoying it that much. I was on autopilot mainly, but this is something I strive towards. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be a rehabilitation physician in a couple of years. So that was obviously the driving force for me to kind of wake up day to day feeling joyful. Wow. And that was, yeah, I was pretty happy with my career. I was married by then, two years into our marriage. And we're still married to my beautiful husband, John.
Awesome.
And then we have, you know, a beautiful network of friends.
Mm.
And it was really like the time of my life, 2008.
Yes.
But I didn't expect, obviously, in September 2008, as I was walking to work. Yeah, I just stepped out of a car, walked in the hospital car park, walked towards work. And then out of a sudden, a car at high speed just rammed into me.
Whoa.
It caught me unaware, of course. And the next thing I knew, I was just lying on the ground in excruciating pain, but I was lying down in a really awkward position. And I knew that I had something's happened to my back because I could feel.
You knew straight away.
Because exactly. I was lying in a fetal position and not being able to move and even feel my legs.
Oh, Olivia.
And that, and that was when of course, I did the doctor thing, going, okay, I don't have a head injury because I can see the sun. I'm conscious. And then I moved my arms. I'm like, oh, I'm not quadriplegic. I'm okay. And when I reached the legs, and that's when it really clicked. Either I have sustained a really bad pelvic fracture or a very severe back injury or spinal injury. That's when I knew.
Olivia, did the car stop and get you assistance?
It was a very interesting, incident because it happened in the hospital car park. So within 5 minutes, I had a code blue and it was interesting.
Good.
You know, like I knew what a code blue was and I knew that's because someone's heart stopped beating.
Yes.
But I didn't realize that the code blue was actually me outside in the hospital car park.
Oh.
I had doctors rushing in to my aid and I guess that's one of the
advantages
advantages of having an injury or a medical event in the hospital car park. They called the paramedics and everything, later on I found out that the person who drove the car was a 92-year-old gentleman with severe dementia who shouldn't have been on the road. And not only that, a couple of my colleagues actually witnessed the accident, so they needed trauma counseling. They were very badly affected by witnessing what happened to me. And that's essentially what happened. I mean, just because of the commotion, I had doctors attending to me. I didn't quite take notice of the driver. Perhaps he was trying to help, I'm not sure, but I was in shock, Tony. I was just gonna say
that shock. Mm. You'll have that few moments or seconds of clarity, and then the shock and everything sets in, and it becomes quite a blurry, pain-filled experience. So I'm assuming that they got you straight into ED, and then that's when your journey started to begin. Did you immediately go into surgery, Olivia, or
I sure
ICU
did.
first or spinal unit?
So I attended the emergency department. Interestingly, in another hospital, not at the hospital where I work in, because that wasn't the major hospital for trauma. So I was transported
that's
to
good.
Another hospital,
good.
Which is the tertiary hospital for trauma in Melbourne.
Good.
So thankfully, I had a really good spinal surgeon who happened to be on call. She's a female spinal surgeon who's excellent in what she does. Yeah, and she basically saved my spine.
Wow.
She came in, and then, I mean, her registrar, David, I mean, I don't know but he's probably an orthopedic surgeon by now, but he came in and, you know, assessed me and all that and organized CT scan very, very quickly. And
good.
It turns out that I dislocated my L1, L2 vertebrae, and I smashed my L2 vertebrae in multiple bone fragments. And all of those fragments, I guess bony bits, ended up in where the spinal cord was, situated. And that's how I had a spinal cord injury. I mean, David felt sad when he gave me the news.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, I was devastated.
Oh, yeah.
But I think it probably occurred to David that it could have been him too. And then I think my accident was a reminder to many doctors that life is short and bad things could happen to them too.
Yeah.
But obviously, at that time, I thought things were really bad. But obviously, up to now, we're talking about 13 years later, my life has taken on a beautiful journey, but we'll probably cover obviously all that in our interviews together.
Yeah,
but at that point, you know, when David told me the news, I was devastated. My husband was next to me when he told us the news.
Olivia.
And then his boss Susan came in and joined us. I mean, they were both really compassionate and very interesting, because I always thought surgeons were very like just don't speak very much, very
blunt and straight to the point.
And blunt. Yeah, maybe not cold-hearted. That's probably not the right word to say. Really blunt and straight to the point.
Yeah.
But you probably had to deal with many of them.
Yes.
But
yes.
Yeah. And so I know. And Susan and David were just the opposite. They were so compassionate. They took the time to tell me every single detail about what's happened and what to expect after the surgery.
Yeah.
So I was operated on that night because my spine was literally unstable.
Yeah, it's emergency.
And when I woke up, I could feel my legs again, but I couldn't move it. But that was when I think the days in the hospital is when I started maybe reflecting and really reality really sunk in, because I was on my own.
Yeah, a lot of the time.
And I had a lot of fears about whether I'll be able to walk again, whether I could be a doctor again.
Yeah.
And I felt like a burden to my husband. I mean, I was 28 and my husband was just a few years older. So, you know, he's had to take on a lot as my carer.
That's right.
And it was
And
hard.
You didn't have children at that stage. And I'm guessing as a woman, you're starting to think, oh my goodness, I may not be able to have or carry children. Those sorts of conversations must have gone through your head.
Absolutely, it did. Not only that, many, many other ruminating conversations.
Yeah.
And a lot of grief. I would go through five stages of grief every day because I just felt really hurt and angry that a lot of people I knew, like medical peers, moved on with their lives. They all went on to have
in limbo.
Literally stuck and paralyzed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Stuck and paralyzed in the wheelchair, in fact.
Yeah.
So I could watch everyone just having awesome lives while I just stay paralyzed. But then, you know, something happened in 2010.
Yes.
The spinal cord injury community is a very small community. There's not many of us.
Okay.
There's probably about, I think in total by now, about 10,000 of us in Australia.
Yeah, not
a 300 new cases. Not big. And 300 new cases of spinal cord injury each year.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of the things that we focus on as spinal cord injury survivors was learning to walk again. I mean, that's the one thing that all of us want to get back.
Yeah.
And interestingly, they were all talking about this particular place called Project Walk. in San Diego. This is in the United States. So of course, I'm part of that conversation. But initially, there's always self-doubt going, why will I travel all the way there? Does it have proven scientific evidence?
Just the travel alone is a mammoth undertaking for a spinal cord survivor. That's a mammoth. That must have been a consideration as well. But the San Diego was leading the way, weren't they?
Exactly. So they were very innovative. They weren't afraid to take risk. And they gave me hope because when, you know, in Australia, I was just told by my treating rehabilitation team to just get used to the wheelchair and learn to live with it. I wasn't happy with that because I never gave up my dream, Tony, to learn to walk again.
Definitely.
It's always at the back of my mind. It's probably in my heart as well. I never gave up. When I heard about Project Walk, although initially self-doubt and cynicism, I guess, or skepticism set in, but I listened to my intuition and she told me to just pack up my bags and go to San Diego, literally. Yeah. And that's what I did. I just told my boss saying, I'm going to take 2 years from work off to focus on my rehabilitation. He was very supportive. And
good.
My husband, John, did the same, told his boss, I'm going to accompany my wife to Project Walk, help her to learn to walk again. That's what we did. We moved all the way
to
San Diego in 2010. We did for two and a half years. We stayed there.
Wow. But the positive side of that was that you got to walk again, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was actually a magical moment when I took my first steps a year later, a year after I went into Project Walk. I started taking a few steps on my own, and that became a lap around the gym. Then it became multiple laps around the gym. And I think when I graduated from Project Walk, I was able to walk from the gym to Starbucks, which is, of course, they like Starbucks. Yeah, with Starbucks. That was good. That was about 500 meters. And I didn't use any sticks. My trainers were with me, but they didn't offer any support or any help. I just walked without any aids.
Wow.
And right now, even though I walk with a limp, I mean, I walk with a limp then as well and now as well.
Yes.
But I was the happiest and most joyful person in the house, really. And I remember thinking to myself when I took my first steps, like, the doctor is back in the house. I remember that. It was quite American, actually. I had American. I know, because I stayed in America for so long then.
You've got the words in your head. Olivia, the evolving medical research around spinal cord injury and people's ability to walk again is really amazing. And that, together with some of the AI robotics and stuff that we're seeing at the moment, makes it very interesting and positive for the future, doesn't it?
Exactly. And I got to use, I wouldn't say it's called AI yet at that time, because we're talking about 2010, but I used the exoskeleton attached to treadmills and fancy equipment. I got to use all that. And
fantastic.
My spinal cord actually got recovered, because I was doing repetitive movement on my legs every day for 5 hours each day. And so that's how I improved my ability in terms of strength, in terms of balance and everything, and learning to walk again.
And again, we go back to that amazing ability of the human body to heal and get back to what it had before. And I think that whole concept of body healing and our ability to use our mind, our muscles, our nerves to regenerate will be the way of the future. And I'm hoping that one day people that have a spinal cord injury will be able to look forward to an amazing positive future through the healing techniques and the knowledge and research that'll go into that into the future. I can actually feel that excitement when you talk about your first steps and being able to walk again. It must have been really amazing. So at that stage, I guess you're thinking, oh my God, I can achieve my dream of being a specialist, and we can have kids and life can sort of get back to what it was. Understanding, of course, that there is a permanent disability there that will impact on you for the rest of your life. What has it been like being a doctor with a disability? Does it change the way that you practice? I know that it's given you a much broader heart-centered concept around rehabilitation, but what's it like for you as a doctor?
Yeah, very good question, Tony, because of my experience of the spinal cord injury, I guess I finally fully comprehended what it was like to be my patients, like what's like to navigate the healthcare system.
Yeah.
I mean, even though I'm coming from a medical background, but
you've been a patient
really,
for many years.
And I think, just having a lot more empathy and compassion for my patients, because now I really get where they're coming from, because I've been where they are, I've been in their shoes. It just widened my perspective overall as well. So not only it made me a more empathetic and compassionate doctor, it just widened my perspective in general in life.
Yeah.
And it just helped me grow so much as an individual.
Yeah.
And I guess the challenges of being a doctor with disability will be the negative biases that I had to encounter when I'm working.
Oh, no.
Yeah, because, I mean, a lot of people knew me before my accident. So they had pretty good, they know how I was operating. I was really very efficient leader, and I could get things done really quickly. But having a disability means that I'll be a fair bit slower.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it was very challenging to do ward rounds, walking with a limp. Yeah,
I can imagine. I was actually thinking of ward rounds as that would be the biggest hindrance, and and you just can't work with that same speed of mobility because it's gone. I do think, though, that your rehab patients must love you because of that understanding and empathy, and they can see, okay, well, my doctor's been there. She really understands what this rehab journey is like. That must give them a wonderful sense of, okay, I can do this, hey?
Very good rapport. And we have good therapeutic relationships. Because of we have a common ground. And then I guess when I say I know what you're going through, I really meant it, because I really have been through what they've been through. And the fear and the anxiety around diagnoses. And so I take the extra effort and time to just explain things to them. I listen a lot more rather than jumping in quickly. And I think patients really appreciate that, because they're used to being like, not say shut down, they're being like, having their doctors really being quite quick and blunt with them. Whereas
not
I think
helpful.
They appreciate being listened to. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And
yeah.
I think that they really do appreciate that very much. The power of listening cannot be underestimated.
That's right. One of the other things that you learnt a lot about was the concept of self-care. And so what does self-care look like for you now? Obviously, it was different pre-spinal cord, and you may not have even been aware of what self-care looked like, because doctors work incredibly hard, long hours, lots of work. And I'm quite sure from my observations, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but a lot of them don't practice self-care actively. So what did you learn from a medical professional about the importance of self-care?
Yeah, I had to learn this the hard way as well, Tony. So when I was a resident, this is way before my injury, I didn't look after myself very well. In fact, I was very ambitious and driven. So I was always pushing myself to obviously stay at work longer hours so that I can, prove to my boss that I'm competent, I'm strong, and I'm not weak. But the injury, interestingly, forced me to slow down.
Yeah.
In a good way. So when I was in America, I learned to look after myself really well, even though I have to work, I have to train 5 hours each day, Monday to Friday.
Yeah.
But I learned to take time to chill over the weekend. We stayed in San Diego, so we could go to LA, we could go to the border of San Diego.
San Diego is great. It's a good place, isn't it? Yeah, I like San Diego.
Yeah, it's a good
too.
Place to. Yeah, was a good place to relocate for 2.5 years. If we had to choose a city that was beautiful, very constant, calm weather, a bit like Queensland, I think.
Yes,
like sunny and The winters are very mild as well. So yeah, San Diego was fascinating. And that's what we do on the weekends. We would go to the beach or we'd drive to LA. And that
Yeah.
was kind of my way of learning to look after myself. But then, when I went back to Australia in 2013, that's when I finished up my intensive rehab period at Project Walk. Went back to work. I had to hustle back into work because I was way behind in my training. Yeah, because like I took 2 years off my rehabilitation medicine training, so I had a lot to catch up. My friends were already specialists by then, and I'm still like first year registrar, and I had to like
Yeah, which
catch
would be
up. And
tough. Yeah, that would be
it
so
was
tough.
yeah. And then eventually, I had lots of exams to be a rehabilitation specialist, to be a pain specialist. Then I had a kid, and then I
Yes.
had my injury to deal with. And
Yes.
then before I knew it, 2019, I had a really severe burnout. Episode, like
Ah.
burnout, how you say a burnout experience. It was very epic because I just literally couldn't get out of bed one day,
Yes.
and I had to tell work I have to be off work for 2 months, and then spoke
Yes.
to my GP, and that's what she said, take time off and all those things. And that's when I knew that burnout is, if it's
A real
left too
thing.
late,
It'll knock you
exactly, it's
off your feet.
it did knock me off my feet.
Same experience. You just keep going and going. It, for women who are highly driven, who are wives, mothers, and devoted to their expertise, whatever that may be. So mine was perioperative nursing. I just kept going. And again, a conversation with a GP that said, you must stop. Your brain has had enough. Your body's had enough. You need to stop and stop work. You need to get some counseling and some help and sort this out, or things will be very bad. And it wasn't until that moment that I realized what burnout, breakdown, overwork, whatever way that you want to frame it, you get to that point in your life where things stop and you cannot get out of bed. And in my case, combined with cannot get out of bed, were constant tears. I could not stop crying, which was unusual for me because very much like Dr. Olivia, I just kept going like an ever-ready battery, just kept going. But your body and your mind goes, okay, enough now. And it's an important conversation for us to have today because so many doctors keep working through this and they don't stop. And it has impacts on life, community and healthcare, doesn't it, Olivia?
Exactly. And I think a big part of doctors, as well as I think I can say for nurses, paramedics,
Yes,
they've
all
been
the caring professions. This is
exactly.
predominant in caring professions because you do
And
care.
I think they're even more burnt out than ever. I mean, they were burnt out way before COVID, and then
And
after the
COVID
pandemic.
happened. Yeah.
Exactly. I think pre-COVID, they did studies on doctors, nurses, and paramedics. It's the same actually. It was quite interesting. The statistics was the same, like burnout rates. It was
Yes.
about 42%. Then
Yeah.
after the pandemic's just come, well, not say gone. I don't want to
It's
say
not
gone because
gone.
it's not gone yet.
It's
It's
hanging
hanging on for a while. The burnout rates have jumped up to probably about 64%. So
Oh,
that's pretty
wow.
much, very high. So you think about it, when I go to work, 64% of my colleagues are burnt out. And there's this thing,
Oh.
this trend, not trend, it's probably a healthcare crisis, I think. It's not a
I
trend.
would agree.
We
It's
talk
a
about that.
healthcare crisis,
Yeah,
Olivia. I would agree.
it's not exactly, it's not the hashtag great resignation. Well, in a way it is, but this is the hashtag great burnout and the hashtag
Yes,
great
great
resignation,
resignation. Yes.
which saw doctors and nurses leaving the profession as we speak at this moment because they're just
Definitely.
so burnt out, so traumatized. They're just saying this is not even worth me, my health, my family, and I'm done. Like that's what's essentially happening in the US.
Yes,
And I'm not, I
massive
think
in
it's
the
already
US.
happened. Exactly. It's happening in Australia as well. I've heard of nurses and doctors who have left the
So
profession
have I. Yeah, yeah, yeah,
because of the
yeah.
recent burnout.
And
Exactly.
in talking about that and trying to explain that to the audience, it's about many elements of your life and imbalance of life. So for healthcare practitioners, let's take the pandemic for instance. They're looking after huge numbers of very, very sick people who may or may not make it and who have complications, and there's an inability for them to step away and have a breath because there's a shortage of doctors, nurses, and paramedics. The workload is massive and has increased over the term of the pandemic, and it has an impact on their mind, body, and soul because they can't step away because there's not enough of them to do the work, and the work is constant. There's no break for them, is there? That's kind of the way. It's an overstressed healthcare system, staffed by overworked, overstressed practitioners, and that's not good for patient outcomes. That's not good for healthcare, and that's particularly not good for the humans that are the doctors and nurses looking after you. So part of the reason why we're talking about this is because you're passionate about the health and welfare of doctors, nurses, but particularly doctors, because they're like us. We don't hear much about this topic about doctors and burnout. We do if you're in the medical profession anyway, but outside of healthcare, not a lot of people are talking about this, and it's important that we do. So, for you and what you've seen, can you describe some of the things that happen when a doctor gets to burnout stage?
So, Tony, by the time the doctors get to severe burnout, because what they have a tendency to do is other than they've been through a lot of trauma after, we have to admit the doctors and nurses have been through lots of trauma during the pandemic. But I speak in context of doctors. Not only they had to be isolated away from their family and friends, because I mean
Correct.
they're working the COVID wards,
Yes.
and they had to wear the PPE, which is the personal protective gear for the audience out there. That's the protective gear that you see on TV, which makes them look like an astronaut all in a way.
Yes.
They had to
Yes.
do that. They have to wear that every
Every
day. It's
day.
really uncomfortable. Exactly,
And it's hot
uncomfortable.
and itchy and just it's claustrophobic, I guess. So as a perioperative nurse or doctor, you're in masks and gowns all the time. But for COVID, we're talking about masks, gowns, suits, shields, everything, which makes working the physical work of medicine really challenging.
Exactly. And not only that, it's the trauma, the vicarious trauma that I was alluding to. Not only they had to witness
Yes.
maybe some of their colleagues die from COVID,
Correct.
family and friends die from COVID, they probably themselves have
Some
had
of them have
COVID, or
died.
some of them has never died, and some of them are so fearful they might get COVID every day. I mean, so my brother is a doctor too,
Yes.
and he's in Singapore, so he was at the front line last year, so
Oh, absolutely.
I got to find out firsthand what it was like. And that was my brother's life for like 6 months away from his family. He had to stay in a separate accommodation away from his young family of two young kids. And then he had to wear the PPE every day. And he was so scared. Like he said, one wrong step and I might get COVID. And then he had to do all his will and everything. It was really like really anxious times for me as his sister and for his
Yes.
family and my parents too, of course. But stuff like that, it's really quite serious and
Yes.
very nerve-wracking. And
Yes.
right now, I think all these doctors are actually recovering from what they had to go through during the pandemic, and
They will
they're
be
all suffering from
recovering. It you don't
psychologically.
recover. You don't recover quickly. This we're talking about
No, it takes
months
time.
and years of recovery to get through the
Exactly.
trauma of managing a pandemic. And so I actually want to just touch quickly on something that's probably just a little controversial, because in Australia we've seen lots of people protesting about their lack of freedom. And as a nurse, that pains me because they're coming from a perspective that they just don't understand the impact of this virus. And by just doing a few simple things, we're not talking about hard things to do. Wear a mask, wash your hands, get vaccinated, stay home with you sick if you're sick, because those things are what protects our healthcare system and our healthcare workers. And the thing is, whether you believe COVID or not, if you get sick, where do you go? You go to a hospital. You expect doctors and nurses to look after you. And we're not looking after our doctors and nurses very well at all. And they're subjected to abuse and demands. I've listened and talked to a number of doctors, nurses, practitioners in the US, and some of the things that they were subjected to because of the pandemic and because of people's beliefs around the pandemic were horrendous, Olivia, just horrendous. And that has an impact on the people that are going to care for you. It has an impact on them.
It definitely impacts on their psyche, and that's that causes the that's why they all resigning in droves, because I don't think anyone should be subjected to such abuse. No.
Agreed.
They should respect behavioral contract. And I wrote about this actually quite recently in
an article for
the Medical Journal Australia.
Yes,
that we should actually have a behavioral contract with the people and the members of the public to prevent such behaviors towards doctors and nurses who are just trying to help them. I totally, you know, get where you're coming from too. And I think they need to realize that, you know, majority of the patients in ICU who didn't survive in ICU because of COVID are unvaccinated.
Absolutely. Where
majority that did end up in ICU for a brief period of time had the vaccination, they got better and they healed up very quickly.
Yeah.
So I think once we show that evidence to them, I think hopefully they get it. But, you know, like, it is what it is.
There's a very vocal, would I say, minority of people. It's very evident. You would have seen it in Victoria, but in Queensland, the protests protesting their loss of freedom. And again, from my perspective, where is your resilience? Where is your care for your fellow man, woman, child, etc.? Where's your empathy for the healthcare workers and the healthcare system that will look after you in the first instance, no matter what sickness you've got? I really think that we need to be educating the public that I believe in freedom of choice, but with freedom of choice comes responsibility and outcomes. And if your decision not to vaccinate has an impact on someone else, that's selfish. And we need to start calling it as incredibly selfish. And yet you have a right to be selfish. However, this is the consequence of your action. And the consequence of all of this pandemic is doctors and nurses are stressed, overworked, and leaving the profession. What does that mean? That means that if you have an accident on the highway, there may not be a doctor to care for you. If you have a heart attack and the hospital is filled with COVID and unvaccinated people dealing with COVID, you may not have an ICU bed. And I think, Olivia, that we need to be talking in these terms for people to start to understand. Absolutely support you to have choice, but there's consequences of choice and there's a responsibility around. It's not your freedom's not being taken away, but your right to choose has an impact on other people, and you need to think, we need to be talking about those impacts as well as people fighting for their freedom. So you would have seen your colleagues in this situation, and we're going to talk in the next interview a lot more about your book and heart-centered medical professions. But I wanted to talk just quickly. You would have seen some of your colleagues. So you've suffered burnout yourself. You've seen it in some of your colleagues. What does that present like for others? Because as humans, we're all a little bit different.
Yeah, exactly. So burnout, there's three particular components to it. That's part of the definition. So the first
Yes.
one of the first symptoms they might notice is being emotionally, physically exhausted. That's the most common one.
Universal one.
And the second most common symptom will be, we call it depersonalization, where they start to disconnect with themselves and others. So they start being cynical, sarcastic, doing a lot of venting.
Yes.
Like, just venting, debriefing all the time, constantly complaining.
Yes.
And then the last thing, I think the last bit, which is a bit more subtle, is their loss of purpose in their work. Because,
Yes.
us healthcare professionals are so mission driven. We're here to help people,
Absolutely.
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that loss of purpose, I think, is the one that gets to nurses and
Most
doctors
of,
the most, because they're
yes.
just losing any sense of passion and purpose in their work anymore. So that's probably the three big signs and symptoms of burnout.
Yeah.
And there's obviously other health symptoms that can happen, like poor
Physical
sleep.
symptoms.
Exactly, the physical ones, like poor sleep or being emotionally quite labile, like being quite cranky
Yes.
at your kids, family,
Yes.
colleagues,
Yes.
patients, the whole works.
Yes.
And also, just starting to second guess yourself and feeling that you're not good enough, and all the self-doubt and anxiety starts to creep in very insidiously. So yeah, it's also the mental and emotional aspects of burnout that we cannot forget, we cannot like ignore, but they come very insidiously. And
They do.
I
They
think
creep up
as
on you.
I know, and I think all of us have very different barometers for burnout. Like, I guess for you it could be could be lack of sleep. For me, it could be being cranky at my kids
Yes.
more than usual. Not saying
Yes.
that I'm
Yes.
not cranky at my kids, more than usual, cranky at my kids. Yeah, and then that will probably be my warning sign going, I think you need to go to some self-care habits. And I know that we were just talking about self-care, but I
Yeah.
think self-care to me, it's a even balance of work and life roles. And I think if we prioritize, let's say, work too much and not life roles, is then that's when the burnout happens, and
That's
vice
right.
versa as well. When we yeah it works both ways.
Yes. For you at that time, Olivia, what did your self-care look like? What were the things in when your GP said to you, you have to stop? What were some of the things that you needed to do to get you back to work?
Yeah. So I started with, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So I started making sure that I slept enough, because at that time I wasn't
Yes.
sleeping very well as well. It was really severe. I made sure that I exercised 3 times a day. I drank 8 glasses of water, like even basic things like that we us
I know.
healthcare people don't do very well.
I was
Help,
just going to
like
say,
just
when you're standing scrubbed for a 6 hour
yes.
surgery, there's no way
Yeah.
you can get that water in. So those are the things that
Exactly. Yeah.
nurses and doctors do to keep the public healthy that we don't ever talk about, but it has an impact on us. And it obviously had a
Exactly.
very real impact on you. So you went back to basics.
Not only went back to basics, I actually got a life coach for myself. And it was quite funny, because a couple of years before my burnout, I was a bit skeptical at life coaches in general.
Ah,
And
yeah.
getting a life
Same,
coach was what actually
same.
saved me.
Yes.
And getting coaching was actually what helped me see my blind spots and everything, and helped me
Absolutely.
recover from my burnout. And I was like, boy, the
Oh,
power of
wow.
mindset, mastery, and just knowing what are my limitations and limiting beliefs are, and how I can
It's
reframe things and just
powerful
empower
stuff.
myself. Exactly. And
It's,
that's how it changed.
yeah, we're going to talk a lot more about, mindset and the imposter syndrome and all of those sorts of things in the next subsequent interviews. It's wonderful that we're hearing from a doctor that these things are powerful, and they are. Once you realize what limits you, what your values are, what limiting beliefs, what are you saying to yourself inside your head? That private place that no one gets to hear about. Are you being kind to yourself? Are you supporting yourself? Are you speaking to yourself in a way that you would speak to your patients? Because if you're not, that'll eventually catch up with you, won't it?
Exactly. How important it is to just recognize that self-criticism, you know, the harsh inner dialogue.
And it is
and
harsh.
I think once we very harsh, and I think awareness is always the first key to just dealing with that. And once we start to acknowledge that it's there, but it's there to actually help us, is when things started to, you know, start to improve. And I think if we keep fighting it, is where things get worse and worse.
I was just going to say, I was that person. Just push it away. Mm. Just fight it. It'll go away. It's not going to go away. You have to actually consciously work within yourself and with yourself to get yourself to the other side. And when you get to that point of complete burnout and breakdown, it's difficult and it takes a bit of work. So if you can circumvent that and the burnout and overwork not happen, you're going to be better off for it. Mind you, a burnout breakdown will teach you loads of stuff about yourself, how you work, how you function, which in itself is a good thing, but it would be great to prevent it from getting to that point, because the consequence is time off work, time out of a caring profession that you love and enjoy, a whole range of wider community impacts as well. Dr. Livia, we've got just a few minutes left. I wanted to just quickly say to the audience that we will be further discussing all of these concepts in depth in our subsequent interviews. But I wanted to do quickly a shout out to how people can connect with you, in particular, anyone in the medical profession who is interested in that concept of life coaching. And you're speaking to the converted, because my life has been incredibly changed by having mentors and coaches. So I'm never going to say don't go to a coach, because they just give you a third party voice that challenges the way that you're thinking, which you can't do on your own because you're too close to you, essentially, aren't you?
Exactly. And for doctors and other healthcare professionals out there who want to reach out to me, you can connect with me on my social media channels. I'm on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram. You can also reach me on my website at drolivialeong.com.au. And my email address is hello@drolivialeong.com. So you can reach out to me in various ways.
And if you're watching this interview, wherever you see it, there will be information and links to all of Dr. Olivia Ong's information. And additionally, if you go onto tonylontis.com and look under co-host, you will see Dr. Olivia's information as well. Dr. Olivia, thank you so much. It's been just a wonderful time talking to you this morning. I can't wait for our next interviews, and I look forward to talking to you then. Audience, that's your lot for this week. Dr. Olivia and I will be back next week with another show on the Everyday Business Show. Bye for now.
Thank you.